Brigadier Page, reel 4.
And I think the modern generation doesn't realize how different a horse war was to a mechanized war.
In one's daily routine, can you give us some idea about how frequently, for instance, in a normal week, say, one would do the duties of an FOO, or how many hours would one spend in the sort of battery headquarters and so on?
Well, you would have normally at the battery, you've got a 6-gun battery, and they were practically always together, and they were nearly always religiously laid out 20 yards apart. And if you'd had time to build them, they were in gun pits. And at the battery, you would have the major, who admitted they would spend all his time at the OP, and you would probably have 3 officers. And the battery captain ran the wagon line. And the subaltern could probably take it that he had 3 days on duty in the battery and one day on observation duties with the OP or night OP or FOO and so forth. One got plenty of change and odd jobs to do because one never quite knew what would happen next. Suddenly a brigade would ring up and say, there's a new battalion going to the line, send a liaison officer to map reference so-and-so by 4 o'clock this afternoon. One had to improvise a great deal, and one had to improvise so much with one's signalers and signalling, because there were never enough signalers, and there was particularly never enough line. And of course, all this line was merely laid on the ground or up along trenches and was always being chewed up. It wasn't airline or on posts or anything like that. And we were good improvisers, I think, and we did all we could to answer the calls that came to us.
Could you tell us something about one or two particular experiences during the operations in the salient in late 1917?
Well, one surprising night remains very much in my memory in October 1917. We were working up for an attack the following morning on Broodsider, supporting the Australians, and we were in a gun position in the triangle between the road and railway at Zonnebeek. And we'd been counter-battered quite a lot during the course of the day. And in the evening, we decided, as we hadn't got anything else to do until the battle began again, say at 5 o'clock next morning, we would withdraw the detachments to some dugouts in the railway embankment about 300 or 400 yards away to a flank. And so, about 8 o'clock we did. And it was one of the noisiest nights I've ever had, but we were in rather good dugouts for the night in this railway embankment, so we were comparatively safe. And about 4 o'clock in the morning, we said, come, we must go back and get ready for the battle, which will start 5-something. To our amazement, 2 guns, 2 4-5 Howes, had completely disappeared. We never discovered how it happened, but 2 guns in the middle of the battery, there were 6 guns in line, 2 guns in the middle of the battery had entirely disappeared, and there was the largest shell hole I have ever seen. I mean, it must have been about 20 yards across, because the guns were normally spaced 20 yards apart. And there was no sign of these 2 guns at all, and yet no very large shell had been fired. 5.9s and 8-inch had been fired at us, and we tried to work out what had happened. We ultimately came to the conclusion that there must have been a direct hit by a German shell on one of the gun pit dumps alongside one gun, and that must have set off a simultaneous detonation in the next door gun, because These two guns took quite heavy things. There was literally nothing left them. There were two large houses, I don't know how much they owned, blown to pieces, but there were no pieces to be found anywhere. And the other four guns on the bear tree were all covered up, embedded with mud, and I think when the war battle started in the morning, we managed to get one into action. And my friends in 29 Bear Tree, who were immediately behind us, were in the same boat. They hadn't lost any guns like that, but they'd got six guns out of action. And between us, the two Bear Trees should have had 12 guns between us next morning in the barrage. Between us, I think we got about three guns into action. Fortunately, the attack went well and nobody said anything. But nobody ever believed us. They said, "Where are your two guns?" And we said, "Well, we can come and look at the hole that they've left, but we can't find any bit of them."
The conditions of life in the salient, can we explore this just a little? So far as food was concerned, so far as sickness, perhaps keeping dry?
Well, food on the whole was very bad. After all, this is 60 years before the days of cave rations and things like that. And we, in active operations, we more or less lived on stale bread, very hard biscuits, and bully beef. Admittedly, one could cook the bully and make it into bully rissoles and things. We didn't necessarily have to eat it cold. But on the whole, in the salient, one was not on a starvation diet, but one was on a very unpleasant diet. And one couldn't expect much else because it was such a terrible labour to get the stuff up there. You see, all the water had to be brought up as well, and the water used to be brought up in the old-fashioned 2-gallon petrol tins, which usually tasted of petrol anyway, because the standard water card, which every battery had in those days, you couldn't possibly get it near them. The gun position. So there used to be a shortage of water for drinking very often. There was certainly a shortage of water for washing. The food was very indifferent. The rains never stopped, in spite of various books on the subject. I read one the other day, General Farrar Hockley's last book on Goffey, where he maintains that the climate in the salient was very nice. I think it was in September 1917, but I utterly disagree with him. I know him well, and I shall tell him so when I see him. Because, as far as I remember, we were there the best part of a month, and I doubt if we ever had a really fine day, and I doubt if we ever had a day without rain. And one walked about in gumboot's thigh, right up to here, and one did what one could. And these poor, wretched drivers who used to come up night after night leading these pack horses with ammunition, and they'd come all the way through Ypres and been shelled all the way through Ypres and all the way up the duckboard tracks of the battery, I always maintained that the drivers had a worse time. In fact, being a subaltern, I was normally in action at the battery. On the rare occasions, and I was a senior subaltern, on the rare occasions when the captain or the major was on leave or away and I had to go and take charge of the wagon line, I found it much more terrifying and horrifying than being in action at Bear Street. It was quite, undoubtedly, to my mind, it was quite the worst part of the war, September 1917 in the salient. I mean, we'd had a nasty time on the Somme a year before, and very bloody casualties, and there a very hot climate, and unburied bodies lying everywhere. Other bodies buried in parapets of trenches, so you walked along the trench and find yourself being hit by an arm sticking out and things like that. The Somme was unpleasant and dangerous, but the salient was about the end. And it's really extraordinarily difficult to realise how the British Army kept going through September, October, November 1917, And I say the British Army, but that, of course, it isn't only the British Army. The Australians were there doing just as hard work as we were on the right of the salient there. And it was the Canadians who ultimately came in and cleared the job up and took Passchendaele Ridge. But looking back on it, I feel that historians ultimately will decide that the salient battle was a most unnecessary battle, and that now that tanks had arrived on the scene, GHQ should have concentrated and fought way down south, the Arras front or anywhere down there. And they proved at Cambrai, after all, on the 20th of November, that the tanks could go straight off on their own with no preliminary bombardment and go for miles. Well, if only we could have saved up our troops instead of employing them up there in the salient, if we could put on a big attack further south of Arras any time in the autumn, and before we'd had to send the reserve divisions off to prop up the Italians and so forth, I can't help feeling that we could have had a much more successful war on the Western Front in 1917. I know the French were in a frightful situation, and I know, of course, that the Navy said they must have the Belgian coast. But I, in my old age, I feel that we made a most ghastly mistake.
Can one remember how much you felt this actually at the time? Did you know, for instance, in 1917 that the French army was in a mess? Did one feel, while one was in the salient, that something had gone wrong, or is this something which you remember in hindsight?
I think for the whole army, practically, except the very senior officers, I think it's hindsight. I don't believe any of us knew what a mess the French army was in. Well, it's true one didn't often see them. They used to participate a little in the salient. But as far as I remember, I'd never heard of the mutinies for months, if not years, after the war ended. I think we had heard these stories about that to save us from U-boats, we must clear the Belgian coast, and therefore we must take Passchendaele Ridge and dash off to Roulers and all these other places, Ostend and so forth. I think we realized that. It's difficult to know how the army did stand what it did stand in 1917 and never broke. And of course, if you read the German accounts, they will tell you more or less the same thing. They reckon they had just as bad a time, if not worse, in the salient in 1917 as we did. I mean, both sides were really fought to a standstill in what would seem now, with hindsight, an extremely unnecessary and stupid attack.
How much briefing did you receive before an attack? And how much were you putting the picture about the general context of what your sort of flanking divisions were doing and so on?
Well, generally speaking, one got precious little. You see, communications are not what they are nowadays. The press told you very little. The BBC wasn't there to tell you what was going on. It's true that we used to get English newspapers quite quickly, with only about 48 hours late, and we got the mail came through extraordinarily quickly. But I'd never remember being sort of assembled and briefed as one was in the Second War and so forth. I mean, the orders arrived. There'll be an attack by Sredev tomorrow, and an enormous map sheet would appear with barrage lanes on, and you would spend ages with a candle working out on the artillery board the switches and things for these lanes. But one knew precious little on the whole. And we weren't taken into the minds of the high-ups at all. And one very seldom saw the high-ups. I mean, we used to see our divisional commander, Deverell, quite frequently. He was a very fine general at that time. He was a bit old when he became CIGS later, before the Second War. And we had a very good corps commander, Haldane, in 6th Corps. We liked him very much for one particular reason, and that was he commanded 6th Corps, and he had commanded 3 Div before. And so he liked to get us in his corps. And his corps invariably held the Arras front, and as we liked the Arras sector, we liked Haldane to send for us and get us back there.